Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Warning, this podcast contains adult language, and you better not tell. And if you do, I'll rip the heads off of all your stuffed animals. I swear to God I will.
Today's episode of The Scathing Atheist is brought to you by the new Muslim outreach program, Million Man March Madness. Fill out your brackets and predict which faith will reign supreme in the coming Muslim-inspired global religious war, and you could win 6 dozen virgins of your choice. And now, The Scathing Atheist.
Why does God allow Bill Maher to go on these blasphemous rants? Because he is waiting for Bill Maher to come to the place of repentance.
Hi there, this is Tanner Campbell of the No God Cast podcast. I'm here to let you know 2 things. The first is that you can listen to my show every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time at nogodcast.com. The second has been said before but bears repeating. We did, in fact, evolve from filthy monkey men.
It's March 20th.
And I'm not a breast man or an ass man as much as I'm a throat man.
I'm No Illusions.
I'm Heath Enright. And from Oral Sexy, New York, New York.
And Moral Sexy, Podunk, Georgia, this is The Scathing Atheist.
In this week's episode, we'll learn that explosions above 110th Street in Manhattan don't count as terrorism.
We'll find a Jewish holiday that doesn't suck.
And Noah will fuck up the George Robin.
I will, but first, the diatribe. Seems like me and Russell Crowe's mom are the only people on the planet looking forward to the new Noah's Ark movie. And no, it's not because they named the movie after me. Look, we're talking about Darren Aronofsky. This is a guy whose movies to this point have been about a mathematician, an old lady addicted to diet pills, a grieving biologist, a professional wrestler, and a ballerina, and all of them have been epic. I'm guessing this dude can do something with an antediluvian zookeeper, too. Now, clearly I'm in a minority, and it seems like hating this movie is one of the few things that religious people and atheists can do together. Everybody seems to have a reason, and the atheist reason is the least stupid, but it's still stupid. So Christians are mad because this movie isn't historically accurate. Now, I haven't seen it yet, and neither have they, but if you're keeping up with the buzz, clearly Aronofsky's taken plenty of artistic license here. He kind of has to. The Bible devotes about 2,000 words to the Noah story. This is something you could read out loud in 6 minutes. If he'd stayed true to the Bible, it would have been less of a feature film and more of a vine. Now, of course, Muslims are pissed off about it because Noah's a prophet, and you're not supposed to depict a prophet because they want to avoid the whole fuckable Jesus thing that Son of God touched off. But I should say I'm being damn liberal with my description of what's pissing off the Muslims, since I could have just as easily have said Muslims are pissed off about it because it's a thing and they're Muslims. Jews haven't come out against the movie yet, but as Bill Maher points out, they will when they see the box office returns. So what about atheists? Well, from what I can gather, a bunch of us are pissed off because it's a movie about Noah's Ark. I've gotten messages from a number of our listeners lamenting the release of this film as yet another hyper-religious cinematic debacle on par with Passions of the Christ or Son of God or Man of Steel. Do we really need another big-budget CGI-enhanced sermon on the silver screen, they ask? And I've surprised a lot of these listeners by telling them that, look, I'm going to watch this on opening night. I'm excited about it. I'm fired up to see what a brilliant director with a stellar cast and a giant vat of money can do with this fairy tale. And I'm no more bothered by the religiosity of this movie than I am with the religiosity of Wrath of the Titans. Biblical stories should be fable fodder for filmmakers. You know, I have issues with the Judeo-Christian religion, not their mythology. When we can look at Jesus and Satan the same way we look at Odin and Kronos, we're done. We win. Pop the champagne. And I look at this movie as a step in that direction. Now, clearly we're not there. You know, the fact that Paramount caved to the demands of the blithering Christies and added a disclaimer to this movie against Aronofsky's will pisses me off to no end. There was no disclaimer apologizing to Vikings for the historical inaccuracies in Thor, The Dark World, and Jesus doesn't deserve any better. But when I hear atheists denounce this movie for its religiosity, that strikes me as petty. There's probably plenty of great reasons to denounce this flick, and I fear that I'll know them all on March 29th. But Darren Aronofsky, in addition to being one of the most visionary directors in a generation, is also an atheist. He didn't make this movie to preach the gospel. In fact, knowing his penchant for dark, disturbing stories, I'm willing to bet that he made this movie because the source material is the most diabolical story known to humanity. See, I've got a guess here, and this is pure speculation, so take it with a grain of salt, but I don't think any religious people are going to get pissed about the air quote biblical inaccuracies of this movie. I think they're going to be okay with the fiery sword and the flaming angels and stuff, but what's really going to rile them up are the biblical accuracies. If you think about all the horror, destruction, and waterlogged corpses that make up the flood myth, this thing could make Requiem for a Dream look like a Disney flick.
They're talking about your Jesus.
We interrupt this broadcast and bring you a special news bulletin.
Joining me for headlines tonight is no longer suspected of racism, Heath Enright. Heath, how do you feel?
I love black people!
Must I now show you the money?
Show me the money indeed. Podcasting all about the Georges and a few apes. In our lead story tonight from the Mysterious Ways file, God firebombed an East Harlem church, killing 8 people, including 5 parishioners, yet local Christians remained faithful because they found an old Bible in the rubble. Wow. Several Kindle copies were also recovered, so luckily the rare information is not lost forever.
Yeah, good New stuff. York God is always doing that kind of shit, you know? He's like, yeah, what are you going to do? 3,000 souls in a terrorist attack? Sure, but did you notice the little cross that I made for you in the wreckage? So I'm just saying, there is a precedent for this kind of thing.
The cross? Come on. Now, let's ignore, just for the moment, the fact that religious people exhibit the psychoses of domestic abuse victims. I'm not even going to mention that. Instead, let's try to figure out what it means that several large glass dildos were also found in the wreckage, completely intact. Now, what do you think, Noah? Could this be evidence of a second coming imminent? Finish times are near? What do you think?
Well, obviously God meant something. And in edited to fill the Spacetime Odyssey allotted news, an Oklahoma Fox affiliate is facing criticism over some impromptu local editing to the Cosmos remake. In episode 1 of the new series, my second favorite living astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson took a minute to talk about evolution, but you wouldn't know it if you were watching KOKH Fox 25, as the station chose to accidentally interrupt this moment of the show with a promo for a news story about a professional redneck killing things with a bow.
How do you censor a science program about evolution? What do they do? Like, blur out the beaks of the finches? Pay no attention to the pattern of the usability of the... No.
Now, Oklahoma viewers say the second episode, which was all about evolution, was free of interruption, though many of them criticized the show for spending too little time on biological diversity and too much time on Shirley Temple hanging out with her curmudgeonly grandfather in the Swiss Alps.
You got a little Heidi joke in there. Well done.
Once in a while, I have a Heidi joke in me.
And in a la carte only news, Saudi cleric Salah al-Fawzan figured out why Muslims kept going to hell. So he declared a fatwa banning all-you-can-eat buffets. Basically, everything that happens in Vegas is illegal in
right,
Riyadh now.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it's the gambling, not the gluttony, that makes the buffet unkosher here. Essentially, the restaurant would be betting against, like, the cool hand lukeability of each patron to eat crazy amounts of buffet food, like, for example, 50 hard-boiled eggs.
You know, it must be nice to live in a country that has all the real problems fixed so they can focus on meaningless bullshit. Must be awesome.
Right, it's not like there'll be a completely useless desert in 50 years. So, anyway, according to Musa Ferber, another Muslim scholar who also possesses fatwa powers, quote, "The Sheikh's reasoning is that the value and quantity of what's sold should be predetermined before it's purchased," end quote. But that's stupid because all you can eat is a predetermined amount.
Yeah.
And that's an impossible standard for everyone, not just buffets. How many dead crabs in each bowl of bisque? What's the milligram weight of a parsley dusting? How many salt grains on a margarita glass? That's stupid. Oh, you can't
I know that
do
one.
That.
It's 38,606. I don't know on the parsley or the crabs, but on the margarita glass, it's 38. I've counted. And in Sub-Zero Wins news tonight, the followers of Indian guru Ashutosh Maharaj insist that their leader is in a deep meditation despite the fact that he's both dead and frozen solid. Despite medical confirmation of his death, his followers insist that he's in a deep form of meditation that traditionally begins with 3 deep breaths and a massive coronary.
Well, these men are nihilists, which is exhausting.
Clearly.
Death, infinite ice snap. Are we splitting hairs? Come on.
Right. Now, it is worth noting that there's probably more to this story than just stupidity. Apparently, there have been accusations that the followers are claiming he's still alive in an effort to maintain control of property owned by the guru, which is exactly the plot of Weekend at Bernie's.
It is the plot.
To the letter.
Exactly, of Weekend at Bernie's. Now, these guys really thought it out pretty well, actually. If you think about it, it's actually a little bit better. If the dead guy just has to sit still inside an ice block and meditate,
yeah,
they don't have to pull off all the wacky dancing shenanigans or anything. Like a bad movie, but a good con. It's like an awful David Blaine trick as an entire movie. It's a David Blaine show.
Right,
it's a David Blaine show. And in Hanukkah of St. Patrick's Day news, Israelis get wasted for something called Purim. So the National Police carried out raids on kiosks, clubs, and parks last Saturday to prevent the illegal sale of drugs and alcohol to all the young partygoers that somehow have a bunch of vices despite the God thing.
And I'll tell you what, man, those Hasidic stoners are hardcore. Have you ever seen kosher cocaine? Those big fucking chunks you just can't break up? Plus, you know, you can't use fire on the Sabbath, so they have to mainline most of their shit, and their needles are all curly, so you have to kind of like corkscrew them into a vein. It's tough, dude. It's tough. Hardcore.
What a weird visual from Rabbi shooting up a corkscrew heroin needle. Now, coincidentally, this holiday finds its biblical origin in the book of Esther, and it's therefore a mitzvah to read Esther this time of year.
Oh, shit.
So, like it or not, Yahweh owes us one mitzvah credit, because we'll be talking about that very book on next week's Holy Babel. So, what I'm hoping to do is save up a bunch of mitzvah credits and redeem them for the giant stuffed Moses. That's what I got my eye on.
Nice. Or we could pool them together and get the plague of locusts, which would be awesome at like a revival or a Nickelback show or something like that.
Now, according to a genuine Jewish person that I know, believe it or not, who learned this from a rabbi, another part of Purim tradition beyond drunken debauchery involves eating a vagina-inspired cookie called Hamantaschen. Now, I'm a feminist, so let's roll with it. 30 seconds on the clock for genital-inspired holidays and their related foods.
Oh,
go.
For what?
That's right.
All
right,
that's hard. You go first.
Yeah, okay, it's a pretty weird one. And the Hamantaschen actually works better as a tradition for Gash Wednesday or something like that.
Right.
Well, hold on now. Purim jobs, on the other hand, call for Felch's grape jelly, I believe.
So. All right. So you're talking about like how on Titsmas you have milk, obviously, and coochies, milk and coochies.
You got the idea, exactly. All right, what about All Taints Day and drizzlings of warm papal syrup, I suppose.
Tasty. St. Fat Dick's Day? There'd be no food, of course, but the traditional drinks would be something like a cock single malt or maybe a Budweiser.
Ah, well done. Topical.
Thank you.
All right. How about Yanksgiving? Cans full of manberry sauce.
Which immediately precedes Hairy Palm Sunday when you, of course, have jerked chicken.
Of course. How about Swalloween? And the tradition would be Twizzlers as a felching straw. Jizzlers. Jizzlers as a felching straw. And I think I should add here, this is one of those moments, how about the uninitiated go ahead and Google felching straw?
Yeah, by all means. We'll wait.
That's a
fun one
since I love to provide good Google ideas.
All right, how about the Jewish celebration of Passover where they harvest pudding from matzo balls?
Twinko de Mayo and cream-filled hostesses would be the delicacy in that situation. Pinko Twinko.
And then on the Vaginese New Year, you could have twat and sour soup.
Nice. What about Girth Day? And the breakfast would be gaping egg and cheese.
Nice.
Everything bagel surrounded looking thing.
Yeah, and that, and maybe Ramadangly bits. Now, there's no, obviously, there'd be no food because during Ramadangly bits, you're not supposed to swallow. So,
watch out for that Ramadan.
And on that fatwa bait, we'll close for the headlines for tonight. Heath, thanks as always.
Ashkenazi Jumanji.
And when we come back, George Robb will be here to cause me to go all unwittingly fanboy. I got a chance to chat with a musician, skeptic, and podcaster that I really admire this week. George Robb is something of a legend in the world of skeptical podcasting, and after more than 350 episodes, he's so good at it that he probably never fucks up his recording rig and loses the first 3.5 minutes of an interview because of it. Unfortunately, those of us who have only been podcasting for 57 episodes apparently occasionally do, so with apologies to Gio and apologies to our audience, we now join my interview with George Robb, already in progress. Now, as a skeptic, are there gigs that you would turn down based on that? Like, would you open for the Pope if they asked you to?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, do you go and do the job because you get to have a bit of a new audience and maybe have some subtle influence, or do you sort of stay away because of a philosophical disagreement? There are certain gigs, you know, I obviously wouldn't do some kind of, if there was an organization with whom I vehemently disagreed on a, like a social level, you know, like some kind of Klan rally or some kind of, I don't know, some, you know, white power, you know, festival wanted me to play and offered me crazy money. I mean, I would never, ever do that. I would never have a tacit agreement, you know, a tacit, agreement with their stance by performing with them. That being said, I've done lots of church gigs. You know, it's fun in that you get to use their money for whatever you want. So that's kind of fun. I mean, I like the philosophy, of like what Moby did, the artist Moby. You know, he did a car commercial. He gave a car commercial. I forget which company it was. You know, they licensed his music. They paid him $100,000 and he took that $100,000 and he spent it on all kinds of, you know, green energy funds and things like that. So I like that sort of idea of sublimating the money from one type of gig, that maybe there might be some slight concern about and using it for other things. But yeah, I would be hard pressed to think of, some kind of a gig that I would not want to perform at, as long as it was open and understood. This is what I am. And this is, you know, this is the kind of music that I do. Or if it's, let's say, the band that I play with, I mean, the band that I play with, which is my day job, the Philadelphia Funk Authority, you know, we've played all kinds of events and some of them I've agreed with and some of them most of them I've agreed with. Occasionally you do a fundraiser for something that's like a little, maybe woo based or something. And you try to balance it out as best as possible and then either take that money and, you know, donate it to someplace or make yourself philosophically balance the philosophical equation or the ethical equation in your mind by taking the money you get and using it for something that will be ultimately good, hopefully be ultimately be good.
Great answer. All right, so now here's a question that I know every musician hates, but for any of our listeners that aren't familiar with your stuff, how would you describe your style? How would you describe the genre you play?
I'm a fan of Talking Heads. I'm a fan of David Byrne, Talking Heads. I'm a fan of Frank Zappa. I'm a fan of King Crimson. I'm a fan of XTC and The Police. So my music sounds kind of like a crappier version of all of those.
Very humble of you to say. What I really like about your music is, you know, there's always something very interesting going on musically, but lyrically your stuff is brilliant. I mean, who dogs the outlet? That is Oscar Wilde level wordsmithery. Great stuff.
Oh, that's very nice. Thank you. Yeah, words are fun, and it's kind of the lyrics to me are a type of puzzle. That it's really, really difficult, but really, really fun and satisfying to solve. You know, you have 12 syllables in this next line and you got to get your point across and it has to rhyme with perturbed. So, you know, you somehow make it work. That to me is part of the fun of songwriting and part of the challenge of songwriting. So yeah, I just love language. I love the English language. I love language in general, double meanings and, you know, subtle puns and use of language. You know, Adrian Belew from King Crimson, I'm a big fan of his. The guys from XTC that know how to turn a phrase and where you kind of can look at it in a different way. I love the challenge of that. So thanks for recognizing that.
Oh, you bet. I feel like one of the ones where it really comes together, my favorite of your songs is Small Comforts. I know you've shared this story a lot of times before, but if you don't mind, can you tell our audience what inspired that tune?
Yeah, sure. I you know, it was about writing about loss as a person that has no belief in an afterlife, and it was after the death of my dog. I had a boxer, a dog that died. I had him for 8.5 years, and it was dealing with the grief and not wanting to succumb to the feelings of believing in a puppy heaven. Because in the moment that felt nice to imagine that his essence is somewhere and alive in whatever supernatural way running across fields, that he still exists. His essence still exists somewhere, offered me a momentary balm or a salve to kind of deal with the loss until I sort of had to really realize and recognize that was a sort of conflicting and self-defeating way to approach it. And to understand that, you know, he is dead, he is gone, and the pain and the hole that I feel sort of in my heart is the price for having had that relationship, and that everything has a price, and especially something as precious as this is going to have a massive price. That kind of irrefutable, you know, dog love for its owner is a very expensive thing. And the way you pay for it is that when it's gone, it really hurts. So I wanted to write something along that vein. And yeah, it worked out. You know, the small bit of comfort that I sort of found, or the way I was able to deal with him being gone in a tiny way that offered me a little bit of solace, was the idea that the responsibility for missing him was mine, that he wasn't going to miss me. He was gone. You know, the synapses in his brain stopped functioning, so any sort of semblance of his character was gone. So he couldn't miss me. The responsibility was completely mine to feel sad, to feel loss, which is how I wanted it, which is how I would want it in any situation dealing with someone that I care for very deeply. Like, I would want the responsibility of dealing with the pain and the burden. So it wasn't a great answer, but it was a much better answer than the idea of imagining him running around in puppy heaven waiting for me to die eventually, I guess. I'm not even sure. It's like right away that just raises so many more weird questions than the idea of he's gone and I get to miss him. And I should treasure that. I should treasure that pain because it reminds me how valuable he was.
Yeah, that thought is really encapsulated in towards the end of the song with the line, "I'm glad I get to miss you, but you will never miss me." That pretty much brings a tear to my eye every time I hear it.
Yeah, it's hard to sing, and I'm glad it's hard to sing because it just reinforces, you know, that value again.
Yeah, well, you know, an honest answer is always a better answer. So. Now, and of course, in addition to your musical career, you're also one of the real pioneers of podcasting. You've been doing your show, The Geologic Podcast, for over 7 years now. So what was the impetus behind starting that?
It was a friend of mine that just, my best friend, Slough, is visually impaired. So he was on the podcast train way, way early, back in like 04, 05. And he sort of said to me, you know, podcasting is going to be a thing. You know, at the time there were very few podcasts, but for him it was sort of his, because of his visual impairment, it was his everything. It was his TV, it was his newspapers, it was everything. And I said, this is going to be a thing. So I started listening and kind of investigating. And then after a few years of that, he came back to me and said, you really should do one of these. So I thought, all right, let me do one and just see what happens. See if I can maybe do this for a year. Maybe, I don't know. Let me try to get a half hour show out just to BS about stuff and maybe, you know, use it to play demos or talk about gigs or whatever. So it was never a long game, never a long plan to, oh, if I do this for 7 years, I'll be able to have subscribers and kind of, you know, I'll travel the world as a podcaster. I'll go to Australia, you know, or I'll go to New Zealand, or I'll do a Scandinavian tour. It was never that kind of a thing. It was just like, let me see if I can do this once a week for, let's say 50. If I can reach 50, well, then we'll reassess. And that was, you know, we got 50, and that was 300 shows ago. So we're at over 350, and now it's just something that I kind of do. And I love it. It has saved me psychologically. It's helped me deal with stuff. It's kind of been this nice therapy. My listeners are very generous and very kind with their ears that they let me vent when things are great and when things are not great. Yeah, it's been amazing. It's been amazing and completely unexpected.
I totally understand what you're saying about it being like that sort of that psychological release for you. You know, I just went through a pretty tough time in my life over the last couple of months, and the podcast kept me sane through it. So
it's amazing, isn't it? It really is this sort of friend that, in the, you know, the best thing a friend can do sometimes is just listen. And here you have an audience of friends, because that's what they are, you know, that just listen. And you get to kind of say what you want to say without judgment necessarily or without any kind of commentary. And boy, it saved my life. It saved my life.
Now, I'm willing to bet that I'm in the majority of your listeners when I say that your religious moron of the week segment is my favorite part of the show. But have you considered what you'll do if religious people stop being moronic? Do you have a backup plan for that?
Yeah, you know, I don't think that's going to be a I think the next type of podcast will arrive. I mean, I'm sure the brain hologram projection show will be here before religiosity stops being moronic. It is one of the go-to sort of segments on my show, and I am never lacking. I mean, people are, again, the great fans that I have and listeners that I have, they're always sending me in stories, and I just have reams and reams of these morons, grails worth of morons, that just sort of are fun to sort of talk about and reiterate. And again, to, you know, it's the stupidity that religion allows to happen as opposed to the people necessarily being stupid. You know, like,
right.
I always want to try to get that clear. And I've stayed away from, you know, horrible stories of children being hurt and things like that. Cause that's just, you know, it's hard to make fun when people are getting hurt, unless the person being the idiot is being hurt, then that's just really fun.
I should say that is not hard at all for my co-host, but that's a completely different subject.
Yeah, I know. But and earlier on, I kind of was there was a reveling in it. But I sort of, yeah, you know, things approaches change after time. But there are enough straightforward Pat Robertson type people saying stupid stuff that there's plenty to make fun of. So.
And of course, if you want to hear more from Geo, you can find him at geologicrecords.net. You can find his podcast by searching Geologic in iTunes or checking the show notes for this episode. And where else can our listeners find you, Geo?
Yeah, that's the best bet. If you just Google my last name, H-R-A-B, Rob, you'll find everything. The iTunes, the podcasts, the YouTubes, the Twitters, the Facebooks, all that stuff. Yeah.
Awesome. It's definitely worth your time. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Noah.
Before we blow out the candles tonight, I wanted to issue two apologies and a correction. A few weeks ago, I declared Dave our most generous donor of all time without realizing that David also donated on the same week, which led to a bit of confusion, especially after I played a Farnsworth quote from David, who mistakenly thought that he was our most generous donor of all time, not Dave. So I want to apologize to both Dave and David for all the confusion. I also want to apologize to everyone for the confusing apology. I wanted to also update everybody on the status of the Diatribe book. It should still be available on the day this episode is released, though it might not be available until later in the day. It'll be on ebook retailers across the interwebs, and we'll have some info on how to purchase your copy on the website, so keep up with us there or look for it online. The Scathing Atheist presents Diatribes Volume 1, 50 Essays from a Godless Misanthrope. Also, if you don't subscribe to us on YouTube, you're really missing out. We just posted the first illustrated version of Lucinda's Bible Stories for Kids, complete with animated ass hamster. So I strongly encourage you to check us out there. You'll find a link on the show notes to this episode on our Facebook page, our Twitter timeline, and of course, at our YouTube channel. Want to wish a happy birthday to friend of the show, Wesley, from the Atheist Nomads podcast. He's grown quite adept at orbiting the sun over the years. Happy birthday, bro. Here's to many more. Of course, I also have to thank Heath for his Occam's razor-sharp wit. I need to thank Lucinda for opening the show, and I need to toss out one more big thanks to the funkiest Caucasian from the Caucasus, George Robb. Once again, you'll find links to his music, his podcast, and more on the show notes for this episode at scathingatheist.com. Also need to thank Tanner Campbell of the No Godcast podcast for providing this week's Farnsworth quote. He's doing some really innovative stuff with fundraisers, secular partnerships, and community building, so I'd strongly encourage you to check out his show, which you'll also find linked on the show notes for this episode. But most of all, of course, we need to thank this week's best people, Tim, Wesley, April, Kenny, Howard, Steve, David, Shelby, Vinny, Jeff, Cliff, Liam, Jeffrey, and Aiden. Tim and Wesley, whose erections are measured on the Mohs scale, April and Kenny, whose very proximity is considered a performance-enhancing drug, Howard and Steve, who kill up to 99.9% of harmful bacteria on contact, David and Shelby, who are so intriguing, Waldo looks for them, Vinny and Jeff, whose orgasms register on seismometers, Cliff and Liam, whose swordsmanship continues to keep the interdimensional invaders at bay, and Jeffrey and Aiden, who are so sexy, the very mention of their surnames just made 8% of our audience come. These 14 noble and valiant souls have earned
their way into both my heart and my outro this week by giving us money. Not everybody has the combination of generosity, sophistication, and raw sexual magnetism required to give us money, but if you think you have what it takes, you'll find the donate button on the right side of the homepage at scathingatheist.com. A number of people have also contacted us to see if they can support us through patreon.com. We're going to be setting an account up there this week, so we'll have more details on that on episode 58, along with more details on where and how you can buy the book. If you have questions, comments, or death threats, you'll find all the contact info on the contact page at scathingatheist.com. All the music used in this episode was written and performed by yours truly, and yes, I did have my permission. I should probably also note that people who read the book are immune to both alien abduction and zombie attack. 100% of readers so far. And 33% of the readers have later had a chance to have sex with my wife, which are pretty good odds. Oh, and did I mention that it opens the door to colonic consciousness? Because why the fuck not?